It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome back to another episode of Alaska Tracks, your favorite outdoor radio program where we listen to excerpts from interviews with veteran outdoorsmen and women. Hi, I'm your host, Randy Zarnke. Last week, we heard from one of my favorite guys, Sam Snyder. Sam had a varied career in the outdoors. He worked as a guide. He ran a wilderness lodge. He was a technician for the Department of Fish and Game, and he loved it all. If you heard last week's episode, you'll recall that Sam has a steel trap memory. He could recount stories from 40, 50 years prior, complete with the names of people and places. Sam was always happy to hear or tell a story, which ended with a good laugh. Let's get started with today's episode. In this first section, Sam tells about his life and activities in the McCarthy area, as well as the start of his time with the Department of Fish and Game.
You talked about seeing all those giant moose when you first came up to look over the job. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get down there and find any of those?
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of the first moose that I killed was right in that valley where you go up to McCarthy, up the old railroad grade, and there was a lake in there called Billy Lake. Howard Knudsen and I flew up there with a float plane one evening. We've seen this bull, and we landed and made a stalk on him, and I shot him. And that was my first moose. He was about a 50-inch bull. Mm-hmm.
No, nonetheless, it was the first.
Right. All these things are pretty exciting. All my dreams in my life had come true. At McCarthy, I'd been living there a couple of years, 2.5 years. Moose season opened. Everybody was hunting. Mudhole Smith, he was a owner of the Cordova Airlines. And there's a book or two about Mudhole Smith. Anyway, he'd sent his boy up. So I got Wayne his first moose just out of McCarthy. So they was all happy about that, and I was happy. So then that one fall, everybody was hunting, and a couple guys from Cordova was up. Bob Dettinger, he was a guide, and also a guide with Wilson. He was a commercial fisherman in the summertime, and then he'd come up there and, when he wasn't guiding, and go moose hunting at McCarthy. And yeah, nobody was getting a moose, so I drove out the road up toward the May Creek, and I was out there maybe 5 miles, and I shot a nice bull along the road. He was just about a 30-inch bull, but it was good and fat. Neighbor and I was up McCarthy Creek cutting wood, looking to cut a few more trees down for firewood for the winter. So we was up a mile or so up from McCarthy up the creek there in this old wood trail. You always had a gun with you. We'd had a bear in town. In fact, one other guy, Jim Edwards, had a hind quarter of a moose that somebody had gave him, and the bear got into it, took the hind quarter. And then somebody seen him up toward Kennicott, and we stopped, and we was looking around at some trees, and looked over toward the creek, and it was making a lot of noise. It was pretty high water, and it was roaring. And here's this damn grizzly, eating berries. So I said, I bet that's our problem bear. So I probably, 75 yards from him. So I just put one in right between the shoulder blade because he had his back to me. Maybe I'll break the spine. Man, I shot and down he went and right back up. And he spun around. He run into a little bit of brush. And this other fellow with me, he had a .44 Magnum pistol. And I didn't want to shoot at the bear in the willows because I couldn't get a good clear shot at him. And all this was happening real fast, you know. By the time the bear broke out of the brush, he's about 25 yards from us because he kind of made a little circle. There wasn't that much brush when I had shot. You know, it was actually pretty much in the open. Then he run into the brush and back, and there was timber behind us, and I think the bear was just trying to get back into the timber. When I got a good clear shot, I just shot him, and then just dumped him, and he just rolled right over. Bud Rupert, he says, God, he said, I didn't think he was ever going to shoot. Well, I just wanted to get a good clear shot. So we backed the Jeep up, and we're going to load this bear up and take him into town before we skinned him. We were wrestling him around, getting him up into the Jeep. We backed into a little bit of a hole and got the bear so we didn't have too high to lift. We're working on that, and we just get him in. We're trying to catch our breath. Here's a nice bull moose standing about 100 yards from us in the damn creek. And I said, Bud, here's my rifle. Because Bud hadn't got a moose. I said, don't shoot in there. I said, wait till he gets goes on across the creek. This is just within 15 minutes or so of these other two shots I had here. This moose walks out, but he's coming from the same side where we were, and he was going on across. So he got across the creek on a little bar over there, and I said, you know, now take him, and he did, and dumped him. So we gets back to town and gets the bear out, and everybody was oohing and all over this bad bear and all that. He was a real old bear. His canines were broken down, and he was actually real thin. So we said, well, we're going to have to dump him out of here, and said, we got to go back up the other side of the creek. And they said, what are you going up there? I said, well, we got a moose up there. Everybody had been just hutting their hearts off. My brother, he was there, and he was about half mad at me. He said, I never seen anything like this. He said, you're the luckiest guy I ever seen. Anyway, Bud and I and his wife went up, and we butchered that moose and brought it back. And I remember Tom Gilmore, we offered him a quarter of that moose, and Tom said, I'd gag in every bite. And then word came down from Fairbanks that Frank Jones wanted me to go into the Alaska Range with him on sheep work, on the rutting observations. And they said, you'd be in there anywhere from 1 to 3 months. We were supposed to go in the 1st of November, and we didn't make it. It was about the 11th of November when we got into Dry Creek with a chopper. We went into the Newman Creek cabin on Dry Creek. We stayed there for about 3 or 4 days and walked up to the middle cabin 6 miles up and did our thing with the sheep. We stayed in there till the 15th of December. Buck Holt came in with the Super Cub to drop food for us, and Lindy's is supposed to package them for airdrops. Geez, they hit that tundra and the boxes were just exploding, you know. And Frank was running like heck, and an onion hit him right in the calf of the leg. Man, it knocked him down. Oh, he was bruised. Good thing it didn't break his leg. We had a half a day just picking up our stuff and hauling it on the hockey all back down to the cabin. Cocoa and the beans, we took a flour sifter and put the beans and this cocoa all in it, and we sifted the cocoa out with the flour sifter. You know, we had some fun times. So we shoot a caribou, so we had fresh meat. And the following year, we had the wolves come into the middle cabin and howled at us and went out there and shined the flashlight on their eyes. And Frank shot at one, finally he missed him. But it was kind of interesting if those wolves would come up that close. We both decided that we probably wouldn't want to have been walking down the creek by ourselves that night. I don't know if you want to call them friendly wolves, but they had been at that cabin earlier that year. When we first got there, Busby had some rain gear hanging on the side of the cabin, and they pulled them down and tore them all apart. They're just playing, I'm sure. And that was the second year that we were up there. We didn't have any meats yet. Over on Lyra Ridge, I could look over there, and I could see there was quite a bunch of caribou. So I went over there, and I shot a little yearling and packed him into camp. And I'd hit the trail and come down where that old airstrip was on into the cabin. And I hung the caribou up that night on the big porch we had there. And I just stayed awake, I guess, until midnight reading, and I went to sleep. And sometime during the night, I heard something scratching. And when I came down the creek, I'd seen a wolverine track. And my first thought was that damn wolverine, he was getting at that caribou head hanging on the porch. So I went to the big glass door he had in that cabin there. And it was a good moonlit night, and no, nothing around the caribou. Oh, okay. Next morning, I got up and I went outside, and here's wolf track all around the cabin. My bunk was over in the far corner, and the scratching that I heard, a wolf had took a leak on the corner of the cabin and then scratched in the dirt just through the wall from me. And I went back out to the airstrip that day, and that's where they cut my track, was on the airstrip, and there was 7 wolves. And they'd follow my tracks all the way into the cabin.
Were you ever involved in any of the survey activities with the department?
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of survey work, particularly for Roush on the moose. Did a lot of it in the Alphabet Hills, Paxson area. I'd go down there and I'd do a moose count in the spring. And I'd also make count on all of the wolf kills. And then the pack size, I'd get dual thing with wolves and the moose. So I put in a lot of hours flying that. And then up here, I used to fly the flaps a lot. And then down in the Granite Mountains on moose work, Al Wright was doing a lot of the flying for the department up here at that time. So Al and I spent a lot of hours flying. And in our spare time, we'd go chase a wolf now and then. One weekend, he called me and wanted to know if I wanted to go down to Cantitia. He had to deliver some mail and some stuff to one of the trappers down there. And we flew down there, and it got kind of gusty, and we dropped in and hit some big drifts and bangity-bang-bang, bang, and the gear on the plane rattled around. Finally got stopped and spun around, pointed into the wind, and I jumped out and grabbed a wing strut. And he had that old family cruiser. The glass gas gauge come down from the wing. So when you opened the door, you push the door up and it would click onto the wing. Little clip there, it would stay open. They had a hole cut in the doors and the gas gauge would come down through this. But it was twisted enough that it bumped it and caused it to break loose, fuel tank in there, and it started leaking fuel. Well, we didn't think about it so much right at the time because we worried about the gear. So I lifted up the wing strut so to pick the ski up, and Al pulled the ski right off of the axle. So I went over to give the trapper his gear, and he came out, and we carried the stuff over to the cabin. So we got a bunch of baling wire, wired the ski back on. We took off all right. Pretty good wind. We just bounced right up in the air. That darn gauge leaking, it come back in the wing and then in through the door, and I was sitting in the back, and I just had fuel all over me. We got just about into Fairbanks, and he called his wife and told her that we was going to land at Phelps Field, not on the river, because we had a broken ski, and we had it wired on, and we was going to Phelps Field to land and to have the city fire trucks come over. They were there. And we come in and landed, no problem. Everything was fine. Wire held, you know. And Al, like he used to do it so many times, we got taxied up Bachner's hangar. He turned around with a silly little grin on his face, and he said, "God, we lucked out again." But I was glad to get out of there and get rid of that stinking parka. God, it was bad. If there had been any kind of spark, we'd have been fried. Close. It was just a lot of fun working with all those guys. Burris was involved with it, and Roush. We collected moose. We were taking repos and fetuses on moose over here in 28. We would collect 3 a month. Most of them we were collecting, we were using those old H-21 banana helicopters from the military had out there. You'd sit there in that door and have a mic so that you could talk to the pilot and tell him to get you where you wanted to be in position. And that got to be quite a challenge, too, because there's so much vibration. You're really shaking in those big old choppers.
I marvel at Sam's accomplishments and the easy way in which he shares those stories with us listeners. Right now, we have to take a break to hear a few words from our sponsors. Thanks to those good folks who sponsor this program. Please give them your business when the need arises. Now let's get back to our interview with Sam Snyder.
Stayed with the department until 66 and enjoyed every minute of it. I got my registered guide's license in 66. Then I came back and worked a number of times for the department as a temporary. In 68, I believe it was, I was doing wolf work for them. That was just before Bob Stevenson started. Roush sent me to Kotzebue in 68. We had an interagency thing with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Elson Walker was doing the flying for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Fish and Wildlife pilot, Howard Bowman, had the 180, and I was flying with Howard. It was kind of neat for a change to set in a nice, warm 180, shoot wolves with that stole conversion kit that he had on. Man, he could just slow that 180 down and in that open country up there. And I remember the first wolf I shot on that trip up there was right out in the, what's the name of that big lake just right out of Kotzebue? Selawik. A wolf hunter's dream. Yeah, here's a wolf out there all by himself, you know, just loping along. We just cruised right up on him and bingo and knocked him over and just landed right there, you know. But that was fun. I did a general game census for Roush on the whole Seward Peninsula. Flew to Nome and down to Koyuk. Stopped and talked with all the reindeer herders and got the information on that. and looked at lots of kills. I collected a lot of specimens off of kills for the reindeer and herds around there and brought this information back for Roush. I think I was up there something like a month and a half. It was a lot of fun. You got to see a lot of country and just great experience to be able to do those things. Then we went on a caribou survey on the North Slope. Frank Jones and I, Ken Nealon went up, Nelson Walker was there, Doc White, the USDA vet from Anchorage, and there was another vet from Missoula. We were collecting caribou up there, taking bud samples. We were staying on the Etivluck River. That's an airstrip. It's a good mile long. We had a big camp set up there, and we had two cubs, so we just took turns flying. I'd go out for 3 hours, and then we'd come back, and I'd get somebody else for 3 hours. Well, we spent about 10 days up there trying to get a good pot of caribou all in one little group to collect. So Nelson and I was flying that morning, and we'd been over on Maybe Creek, came back, and it was on the Colville, and we spotted a little pot of 10 caribou. So I had my shotgun, and so we shot all 10 caribou, and then went back and picked up the rest of the guys and ferried everybody over there. So we had the whole day that we worked. And there was a blonde-covered grizzly right across the other channel on the Colville, like 100 yards across there. And he'd run out, and he was all upset about all of those airplanes. At first, we thought it was because he could smell that blood over there. He'd come into water a time or two. And Nealon said, "Oh, I'd love to shoot that bear." And Nelson said, "No way you're going to shoot that bear." You know, of course, the department would let him even think about it. That afternoon, Nelson and I flew across there and took a look, and he had a caribou that he had killed. And it was up in the edge of the willows. Boy, he was really upset with all the big birds of the Super Cubs flying around there, and that's what it was all about. Flying up there with that bunch of guys. Did all of our own cooking, and we just had a lot of fun. The first night, everybody was supposed to be there, and nobody showed up. We didn't know they'd had bad weather in Kotzebue and couldn't get out of there with the beaver and the other Super Cub. So Frank and I didn't have much to eat. Well, we had emergency rations. We didn't want to break into that, so we shot 4 ground squirrels, and that's what we had for supper that night. We fried up those ground squirrels, and so it was better than nothing. It was kind of another interesting little thing that we did. Anyway, then when I got to guiding more and working up there with Pete in the Brooks Range on the Itkillik, one hunt that really sticks out in my mind, we had 4 hunters. They were the last 4 hunters of the season, and they were all from Pennsylvania. Real good hunters, real nice people. And the older person, I hunted him first, and I got him a nice ram, a little better than a full curl, and he was just real happy. That was my biggest concern. These guys had about 2 weeks they could spend. So we hunted and hunted and never got any more sheep. After about a week, Pete and I talked about it. I said, "Why don't you move us down? We'll set up a camp and go down to Island Lake." Pete stayed, and we had 2 packers with us. We had 3 hunters. So we had 3 sheep to get. I decided to climb that mountain west of Island Lake and went up over the top with the one hunter that morning, and there was 2 good rams across the Akilik on the other side, so Pete was going to take the 2 hunters and go over there. So we climbed that mountain, and I finally got a nice little full curl ram for this one hunter that day. I knew it was in kind of a steep place. I'd never been in there before. Anyway, the sheep fell, rolled and rolled, and finally it went out of sight. I thought, ooh. And finally, we got over to the edge, and we looked down, and boy, it was steep down in this creek bottom. It was quite a ways down, but there was kind of a shale slide that went most all the way down, some spew outcropping of rocks. We could see the sheep laying there, of course, and we got down there and got him caped out and boned the meat out. I'm sure I could go upstream. I knew I could get out that way, so we went upstream. It was a little bit more time-consuming, but come out and got back into camp, and so we had a sheep, but Pete didn't get any sheep. So we pulled camp the next morning and went back up to the main camp. So Pete took this other hunter and flew him back to Ramport. They went black bear hunting. So I had these 2 hunters, Leon Martin and John Snyder. We had an old Trackster, and we took that thing down to this other canyon below the main camp. And it took better part of the day to get down there, and we went up and hunted one little valley that evening and didn't do any good. And boy, time was getting close because they had one more day to hunt. So the next morning, I spotted some sheep up the main creek to the east. We went up there and I got them about 450 yards as close as we could get. And we were about even up the mountainside from these sheep. I think there was four rams, and two of them were real good rams. One was broomed pretty bad, but he was a real nice ram. So Leon took a crack at him. It was just as he was starting to go out of sight, and I seen him stumble when he shot. And I said, by golly, you hit him. So it took us probably 20 minutes to get over there. We couldn't find a hair. We couldn't find a bit of blood. We couldn't find nothing. So we're standing there looking, and I had both packers with me, and they were up about 20, 30 feet above us. It was real steep, and they were looking, and then there was quite an outcropping of rocks up there about 75 yards. And all of a sudden, here this big ram shows up. I said, Leon, there. He's up and he shot him. Boom, down he comes. I mean, rocks are coming, and this sheep ends up not any farther from here to that door from us. And by that time, this other full curl shows up. And I said, John, shoot. And he shot. We've got pictures of these two rams side by side. And they both fell within 20 feet apart. It all came right together, and it's the last day of their hunt. You talk about a climax. That hunt was one of the most fabulous hunts that I ever guided on. Man, yeah. It was exciting.
Okay, Sam, any stories about wolf hunting that stick in your mind?
There's a couple. One time, we've been over at Dry Creek, coming back off the sheep thing, and Buck Holt, which works for the protection division, I was the last one to come out, and we got over to Blair Lakes, and there was a big black wolf in that airstrip. So Buck said, we got to shoot that wolf. And I said, fine, I had a little shotgun. So we cruised in on him, and we rolled him over. And it was cold. It was about 35 below. And it was getting late in the afternoon. We said, boy, we're not going to mess around skinning it. We'll take it back to town and skin it. Threw the wolf in. I'd ridden in a couple lot of times with two or three wolves because it was too cold to skin them, and you just throw them in there. And between the blood and those warm bodies off those wolves, and of course they defecated all over, and you rolled up with all of that stuff, and it's too cold to open the window on the cub and let some of the bad stink out. You'd sit there for sometimes, you know, an hour or two before you got back with all that, and then of course, you know, every dog would come anywhere near you would bark and growl at you. They didn't want any part of you. And speaking of dogs, that's another funny thing that happened back in the coyote trapping days. There used to be an old saying among the game department guys in Washington that you were never a true coyote trapper until a dog took a leak on you. Well, one day I was this sheep rancher. I was doing some coyote trapping for him, and my hands, you know, I'd get scent on them, and I'd end up wiping them on my pants, and I never paid too much attention. You're around that smell all the time, so you never noticed it. He had a big German shepherd. I was standing there, it's a hot summer day, and I got a couple coyotes on his ranch there that day, and we're standing there talking, and all of a sudden I felt something warm on my leg. I looked down, and here that damn German shepherd was taking a leak all over me. He kicked the dog in the butt, you know, and of course the dog yelped and run off. And I was telling my other trapping friends about it, and they said, well, you're a true coyote trapper now. So I just smelt like a scent post to that old German shepherd, and he did a number on me.
And you can still laugh about all that stuff, too, huh?
Oh, yeah. That's part of all the great experiences that a person has in this field of work. Of course, I ended up doing skinning and fleshing and taxidermy work for Kleinbergers for years and years and years. Still do it for the department, Fish and Game, here. And cleaning, bleaching some skulls. Pretty much retired out of all of it, but there's two or three guides that I take care of their skulls. A few people I still handle some stuff for, and keep my fingers in it. But of course, I had a great life with all these experiences and still made a living at it. The good days, I've really seen them up till the present time. There's still lots of good days here. It's just we need good management and good people. There's so much pleasure in it. Wolves and sheep are two of my favorite animals. I just love them to death. And yet I've taken a lot of them and had my share of it. And I enjoy every bit of meat. I'd rather eat wild meat. My whole family's the same way. They'd rather eat game meat than they would store-bought. My kids all grew up with this hunting and trapping and fishing. They're all good kids. Never had any problem with them. My kids were going out on the trap line with me when they were 3 years old. I went to a lot of the grade schools and put on slideshows and explained to the kids, there's only a few of them that are killing sheep. So you take the one problem animal out, you're not worried about the rest of them. There's still plenty of them there. In a way, you're just like a farmer. Farmer doesn't keep a non-productive animal in his herd. He has to cull it out. That's basically what all this is about, is just general farming management, which I know that this is a dirty word anymore. It's a great thing to be able to trap and for people to take their kids and show them how to trap and learn the ways of the animals. You got to learn to think like that animal that you're pursuing. Where is he going to cross the ridge at? What would you do? You got to know exactly what he's thinking, how he's going to get away when you spook him. You get a feeling for this, and this is something that a lot of people just don't have because they haven't had the time. I did it all my life, and so I can walk up a creek or walk down an airstrip out here, and I can spot, say, boy, there's a place where you want to make a wolf sit. You can see that clump of grass, or you can see this rock, you can see the bend in the river. This is where you'd make your sets. I could go on for days talking about different experiences I've had, but, you know, being able to hunt and fish and trapping from the time I was big enough to pick up a fishing rod and being around people is such a great experience, and I made a life and a living at it.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. I hope that over the past two episodes, you've come to admire Sam Snyder as much as I do. Tune into Alaska Tracks again next week when we hear from another veteran Alaskan outdoorsman.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.